Welcome to Designed You, the show about people pursuing their passions. I'm your host, Garrison Lakem, and my guest today on Designed You is one of the world's iconic guitarists. He's a founding member of the legendary New England group, the American Standard Band, appearing on their self-titled LP. In 1976, he answered the call to become Joe Cocker's lead guitarist, where he stayed until 1988, sharing the stage with the likes of Nicky Hopkins and Bobby Keys, and recording Luxury You Can Afford, Cocker, Live in Central Park, Standing Here, and Live in Montreux, famously appearing on singles like Leave Your Hat On and Grammy winner Up Where We Belong. Along the way, my guest has worked with John Mayall, Steve Miller, and Robert Palmer, appearing on Palmer's Secrets and on singles Bad Case of Loving You and Suspicion, and also on three Billboard Hot 100 charted singles with the New City Rockers. I'd like to welcome to Designed You, Cliff Goodwin. Welcome, Cliff.
Well, thank you very much. Who is this guy you're describing? He's amazing.
I love when my guests have done incredible things because I love doing the intros.
Well, that's quite a charming and lovely, kind introduction.
So, Cliff, how did you and the guitar first get to know each other, and what memories do you have of your Capa Continental and the Silvertone Twin 12?
Garrison, how do you know about that? Very few people know about the Capa Continental.
I tell you, I do my homework, Cliff.
You really, really do. And the Silvertone Twin 12, of course, you know, was an iconic amplifier. The Capa Continental was actually the first real guitar I had. The one before that was a Howard. And I'm not even sure if it was really a guitar. I know it had strings attached, but it was certainly of dubious ilk. But, you know, the answer to the early answer to your question is where we begin. We begin with the Beatles. And, you know, February 1964, we were dabbling with the guitar a little bit, but certainly our pathway wasn't as clear as it was after the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. That was devastatingly vivid.
I remember watching it live.
I think it was February 8th or February 9th, 1964. Let's assume it's February 9th, just for the fun of it. I'm sure your listeners will correct it if need be. But there's a statistic that's very telling. Something, it goes something like this. There were about 1,000 bands in America on February 8th. On February 10th, there were 50,000 bands.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty, and I bet you that figure is pretty close to being true. It took us by storm. Everybody said, I want to do that. Now, not everybody was lucky enough to continue to do it. A lot of people got sidetracked with other interests. But early on, that was a passion. And we're running on faith. I mean, essentially, you know, that's essentially it. In a way, we still are.
Who were your particular rock and roll models when it came to what was going to emerge as your particular Cliff Goodwin style of playing?
I am, yes. Heavily affected, definitely influenced by what I call teabag rock, which is all the English guys. And I'm not necessarily talking about British Invasion, not the Herman's Hermits and Jerry and the Pacemakers, and even not the Beatles so much. They were the impetus, but they didn't. They weren't the guys that kept us going. I'm thinking about Cream, Jethro Tull, Free, Bad Boy Brown, 10 Years After, the Jeff Beck group, Zeppelin, of course, the Yardbirds a little bit before that. Those were the things that really got me going. I mean, without a doubt, you know, that's in my DNA. Ironically, I remember as probably a 13 or 14 year old to Joe's first album, and knowing it by heart, not ever dreaming that I'd wind up with him, and just literally devouring the record, the lineups. You know, there was a number of people on that record: Jimmy Page, B.J. Wilson, Henry McCullough, Chris Stanton. I know them all, and at that age, to just devour that record, and then eventually wind up with the guy, is pretty spooky. In retrospect, looking back, I mean, we can look back now, and when we were in the middle of it, it's like you're in the middle of a hurricane. You know, you're just busy trying to stand upright. You know. But after it's gone by, you say, whew, what was that? Subsequently, to meet all these guys, to meet Clapton and Winwood and Page, and you know, it goes on and on. And when you're meeting them, be absolutely tongue-tied, dumbfounded, and you sound like a bleeding idiot. I love playing with Christine. She gives me a lot of latitude to have a lot of fun with her songs, and I cherish that. I really do.
How did it happen that the guitar morphed from being an interest, something that you said, this is pretty cool and fun to do, to your deciding, it's more than that. Here's how I want to spend my life.
I don't think at 13 or 14, you're not thinking much more than a couple of weeks ahead. We're definitely talking about a passion. I was brought up by my grandmother, who came out of the Depression era, and she noticed rather quickly that I could make money. I mean, we started playing literally the week after we said we had a band. And you notice my terminology is said we had a band. I'm sure we, well, to keep it family and family friendly for the radio audience, we kind of sucked. I'm sure, and didn't have a clue, but you could get work. I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts, and there were at that time 13 colleges in Worcester, and a lot of the colleges had fraternities, and the coolest thing that they had was parties with bands. So we had work. My grandmother noticed that hey, this kid could actually make some money. And, of course, when you come from a Depression-era experience, a job is life. So, you know, and, you know, good wise words from her, words like, if you make $2 this week, save one. You might not work next week. Because this, again, is that Depression-era theory and model and doctrine. And so all of a sudden, $2 turns into $5, and $5 turns into $10, and you know you're making money, and then you wind up with other guys who are like-minded and serious about what they're doing, and before you know it, you have a job, but it's a passion, and you know what they say about that: if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Now you're a person who's taken a passion to a profit and to a very successful career, and there had to be a point there where there were some real challenges, you know, about making music your career and your life. And you hear those stories about bands, you know, playing gigs anywhere they could and frying dog food to stay alive, kind of thing, you know. Do you remember some of the struggles you went through and how that got you across the bridge?
Ironically, you mentioned American Standard. There was a point in American Standard when, in like 1975, maybe the beginning of 1976, was actually the lowest point of that band. We were barely surviving. And your description, with the exception of the frying dog food, is pretty apropos. Ironically, within 9 months after the lowest point, we connected with Joe Cocker and made our way towards the highest point. I recall that as a very low point. But, you know, it's funny. I don't think we ever really woke up in the morning and said, I'm going to quit this and go get a straight job, if you will. we just kept on.
How did the stars align that you became Joe Cocker's lead guitarist, a gig that lasted 12 years?
We eventually hooked up with a manager, American Standard. This is, again, before Joe. And his whole claim to fame, if you will, was he managed a recording studio. Now, back then, of course, you know, you can make a record in your broom closet if you want. Back then, you needed a recording studio. So we connected with this gentleman and started making demos. He also knew Joe's manager, Michael Lang. Just through happenstance, I guess they were talking, meeting somewhere, totally unrelated, and Michael Lang had mentioned that, you know, Joe's band had left him, and they were looking for some guys who could play but didn't have any baggage. As a matter of fact, in Bobby Keys' autobiography, he refers to us as a bunch of Pat Boones. The point is, and he referred to us in a loving way. I was friends with Bobby right up until his passing. Fantastic mentor, great guy. In any event, they wanted a band that really didn't have a lot of baggage. We proved ourselves as far as being a working band. We still had a lot to learn, and we still had a long way to go. But we had a good work ethic. And basically, Michael came and saw us, Michael Lang. Okay, we passed that obstacle, that audition, if you will. And then, of course, the next thing is Joe's got to come and see us, and he did. Saw us at a place in Ashland, Mass., called the Widow McCoy. I'm sure it's not there anymore. Who knows what it is? Probably a Starbucks. But I remember the place vividly. And he came and saw us on a Saturday night. And he was well into his cups a bit, as Joe would sometimes do. But then we rehearsed with him the next morning, late morning, early afternoon, at this place, because we were, you know, back then you could do it. And when you were playing a nightclub, you'd be playing at six, sometimes seven nights a week. And we passed the audition, and he hired us. Okay, all makes sense. However, the little theory about having a band with no baggage kind of got somewhat diluted, because they augmented the band with Mickey Hopkins and Bobby Keys from the Stones. So Joe had playmates, and we had people we revered and learned a great deal from. Mickey Hopkins was an absolute genius. And he was so unassuming, just a really lovely guy. If he had a couple of drinks, he'd get a little bit rambunctious and belligerent. And I hate to say that, but it's kind of true. It shows you how the demon rum can get you. Aside from that, Mickey was an absolute musical genius and showed us a hell of a lot about really how to serve the song. I think the best thing I can say about my whole experience with Joe for that long of a time would be learning how to serve the song. That's why we exist.
There are stories going around that there is some kind of special experience when you were recording Fun Time with Joe Cocker. Do you want to open the shades to that a little bit and give us some insight into the recording experience of Fun Time?
Yeah, Boy, Garrison, you know too much. You must work for the CIA or something. Joe had started recording Luxury You Can Afford, which was on Electro Asylum. That was one album on Electro Asylum with Stuff. The band called Stuff, which is Steve Gadd and Cornell Dupree, Gordon Edwards, Richard T. And they were down there a good long time and didn't get a lot of tracks. I'm not quite sure why, but the chemistry, the producer, by the way, was Alan Toussaint. Yeah, I don't know if the chemistry was really that good. So this was all being done at Criteria Studios in Miami. So they wanted to basically give us a chance, you know, have Joe's road band come down and do a few songs and kind of toss us a crumb, really. We were happy to do it, though, without a doubt. But when it came time to record, We did a couple of tracks. We did a song called Boogie Baby. We did another tune that I can't remember the title of, but I don't think it even made the record. But Alan Toussaint came into the studio, and we were sitting there. It was me and John Riley on drums, Howie Hirsch on bass, and Mitch Shakur on alternate guitar. And because at that point, Nicky had retired from Joe's band, and Mitch had taken over Nicky's chair. So Alan Toussaint comes into the studio and says, I've got a song I want you guys to try. And we said, fine, can we hear a demo? He said, no. I said, well, can we hear what, I said, did you already record it with stuff? He said, yeah, we tried it with stuff. I said, can we hear that? He went, no. I said, well, how do we know what the song is that we're supposed to try to cut for you? And he said, I'll sing you a verse, which he did. And then I'll sing you a chorus, which he did. Mitch says, well, what are we supposed to do with that? And Alan Toussaint blessed him, said, you're a professional, you'll think of something, and he left the studio. They set us up to fail. By the time he came back two or three hours later, the record you hear was cut. We ran with it, and that's what you hear, augmented with a few things from Barry Beckett. But the record you hear was what we did. Now, the engineer for that, it goes a little bit further. The engineer for that session was the guy named Alex Sadkin. Alex Sadkin, among other things, was a brilliant engineer. But he engineered I Want to Know What Love Is by Foreigner. A lot of other things he engineered. Anyways, he said to us, he said, who are you guys? And we said, well, we're Joe's road band. Yeah, I guess I heard that you were coming down, but look what you just did. And he said, I'm leaving Criteria Studios in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to be a staff producer with Island Records. Do you have any demos? Well, the leader of the American Santa Band, Kevin Falvey, was also there, and he just pulls out this cassette and says, here you go, check this out. The funny, you know, the ironic thing, Garrison, is it's all the stars have to align. You know, bands try forever and ever and ever to get signed. We went down, we did this work for Joe, on Luxury Can Afford. This guy, Alex Sadkin, meets us. He's leaving there to go to work for Island Records. Within 3 weeks, Chris Blackwell, owns Island Records, comes up to Boston to audition us, quote unquote, and signs us. And yeah, and it was really funny. Later on, many years later, actually not many, but a few years later, we became mildly acquainted, so to speak. I would say friends, because of his echelon is way up in the stratosphere. But we were recording some tracks for Sheffield Steel, Joe's first album on Island, and Chris was producing it. I had asked him, I said, well, you know, when you auditioned, so to speak, American Standard, why did you set us up? They set us up in a jingle studio where the control room was actually bigger than the actual studio. I said, why did you do that and not audition us at a gig? He said, well, if you were at a show at a gig, you'd be trying to impress your girlfriends, and you'd stack the audience with all your fans, and you'd be distracted and all the rest of it. He said, I just set you up in this jingle studio, had the engineer plug everything in, turn every mic on. I closed my eyes, and I said to myself, does this sound like a record? The answer was yes, and I signed you. Well, Chris Blackwell was an absolute icon, brilliant. I think he's on the level of a Clive Davis as far as understanding vision and things should go, concept. Well, for example, I did a couple of tracks for Sheffield Steel. You will not see me appear on that album, because after we did them, everybody went nuts and thought they were fantastic, good rocking. And Blackwell looks at me and said, Cliff, that was great, but I can't use it. Won't fit on the record. Because most of the record, all the record, I think, was what the rhythm section was Sly Dunbar and Robbie Slake Shakespeare. And it was a really, really reggae-ish kind of record called Sheffield Steel. And, of course, that's as far from Cliff Goodwin as you could get. So, you know, but he was very kind, and I was sad. But I understood that he stuck to his guns. The album has to be the way he envisions it, not just throw cuts at a wall and see if they stick. You know? So that's the extension story that you asked. You asked. That's what it is. And Fun Time off Luxury Can Afford was the only charting single off that album.
Cliff, you've played a whole bunch of different kinds of guitars. What goes into making a guitar feel right for you. And once you've bonded with that almost perfect guitar, how do you deal with the loss of your 1967 Gibson ES-335?
Well, there was no loss there. I sold it. Yes, folks, he's an idiot. I was playing that for many years straight. That was my only guitar. And ironically, around the time I did the Robert Palmer album, I think I broke a string, and I picked up my second substitute guitar, which was a Fender Telecaster. And all of a sudden, everybody in the control room sat up. And that was very noteworthy to me, because the 335 is a great guitar, but it's a jack of all trades. It's really a master of none. I have to say that. And I'm sure people will disagree with me, but that's how I feel. It doesn't commit like a Les Paul, and it certainly doesn't twang like a Fender. Great guitar, though it is. But I sold it in 1983. I mean, I wasn't even playing it for a couple of years. I had gotten an endorsement with Yamaha, and they put a model called an SG-2000 under me and presented me with quite a few. And those are lovely guitars. Yamaha really, really put a lot of love and research and money into making that model guitar. It never took off. I guess there was no cachet with it. But the guitars, to this day, you said you've seen me. You've seen me with that guitar. I still use one of those models, the SG-2000 Yamaha double cutter. It looks like an SG, thick like a ball. Yeah. And I use that with a Tele. And I alternate them, for sure. But the 335 I sold, I assume you're alluding to the story about how I got it back. I was at a gig in Worcester. This guy comes up to me and says, I think I got one of your old guitars. I said, you're kidding. I said, describe it. So he described it. And I said, can I come over your house tomorrow? Because I can't believe that you. This is, by the way, the guitar was sold in 1983. This conversation I'm having with this guy is in 2012. Okay? So 17 and 12, you're talking about 29 years later. All right? I went over to his house. He walks out with this hard shell case. And I'm looking at this case. I'm saying, well, it certainly looks familiar. And I start peeling off some of the stickers, and you see underneath is stenciled Joe Cocker Band. Place it stenciled the American Standard Band. I open the case, and there it is, the 335. This is 29 years later. And I said, how did you get this? He said, it just came to me because someone owed me some money. But I happen to know that it's been around this country. Went to Texas a couple times. Almost went to Australia, but on eBay, I guess they didn't satisfy the reserve. Guy, but not from this guy that owned it, but he knew about it. And I said, well, you know, his name was Dan Hunt, this guy. Lovely, lovely guy. I said, Dan, you realize I've got to buy this back from you because this is kismet. It really has to, you know, even though I probably won't ever really play it because it doesn't satisfy my ears like it used to. But I have to buy it back. He was so nice that he sold it back to me for $1,800, and this guitar is worth probably $4,000 or $5,000. But he had $1,800 into it, and he said, "That's all I need, Cliff." You know, I said, "Great." So that was a really funny story. I was talking to a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine named John Butcher, who has a band called John Butcher Axis. Who I was actually in the original John Butcher Axis. I helped John start that band in a fleeting 6 months period when I was really off the road with Joe. But John, I was telling him the story. He said, I'll call you right back. So instead of him calling me back, this guy, Willie Mosley from Vintage Guitar, calls me back in about an hour. And he I said, hello. And he said, is this true? I said, what do you mean, Willie? He goes, John Butcher just told me the story about the 335, 29 years later, da-da-da-da. I said, yeah, Willie, it's true. He said, the only other time I've ever heard this was when I talked to Peter Frampton, and he finally got back his Black Beauty, Les Paul, that was gone for a couple decades. He said, we're going to talk tomorrow, and we're going to find out the bottom. We're going to get to the bottom of this story. It's really funny.
What's it like playing with Beehive Queen and former SNL band member Christine Ullman?
She gives me a lot of latitude to have a lot of fun with her great material. and it's right up my alley. You've heard it, I'm sure. You've seen us. A lot of times a songwriter has an idea about how they want people to play their stuff, and that's well and good, and certainly they're right. But with Christine, she really lets me really color her songs, create, oral textures. It's just really a really rewarding time to play her material, without a doubt.
When you reflect back on what is an amazing career in music, what are you most proud of, Cliff, and what have you learned about yourself along the way?
I think what I've learned is what I always knew, which is I really just want to do good work. I used the term a while ago, serving the song. We certainly learned that with Joe, because Joe Cocker's material is all about the song. When you spend years really focusing on that, it can't be a bad thing. It really, really is. And of course, Joe's material went from from almost jazz, rhythm and blues, right up to rock. So that it was challenging, and it was a great, great learning and foundation experience for the rest of my career after I left him, to be able to really do a lot of sessions and really grasp a lot of different kinds of songs, because he was no one-trick pony.
I came across a quote of yours, and I want to share it with listeners. You once said, pretty much, we all come from somewhere. I mean, even Joe Cocker was a ditch digger. He was a gas fitter before he started singing. We all come from roots, but you got to work. Like I tell my kids, what you do is not as important as the fact that you do something, that you produce. How has that value shaped your personal definition of success?
Totally. Again, I go back to my grandmother. That you've got to produce. You've got to live. You've got to, at the end of the day, you want to be able to say, oh, I did some good work. And Clapton actually basically coined a phrase and said he just wanted to be accepted among his peers. He wasn't going for superstardom or virtuosity or, anything like that. Just do good work and be accepted among his peers. And I think I'd have to concur and basically say kind of the same thing, It's important that you keep doing something and producing some good body of work. I really think so.
What part of your playing in a band at Forest Grove Junior High School continues to shape who you are right up through today, not only as a performer, but as a person as well?
You have a job to do, and the job is to not only entertain, but really convey your passion to the people listening who are passionate as well. Music is very, very important to many, 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 many people in many, many ways. To a certain extent, a musician is a conduit, and maybe that's it, and it hasn't changed. When we first started in someone's garage or someone's cellar, you're trying to reach, whether it's 10 people or 100 or 1,000 or 100,000, you're still trying to reach them.
Cliff, if there was one thing you had the power to change in the world, and you could change anything at all, what would it be?
Create peace, true peace. What's the phrase? Garrison, music soothes the savage beast, right?
Where do folks follow you and keep up with you, where you're going to be and all that good stuff?
If you Google me, you can find out things I'm doing. Of course, Christine has got a very important and popular website, the Beehive Queen. We've started a new project called Parker Rocks, which is, I don't want to say it's a tribute because it's really not, but it's in the spirit of Joe Cocker. We found an English singer who is really, really taken with Joe, and we put together a band consisting of a lot of Joe's old bandmates. And so that's another thing I'm doing. I'm kind of a hired gun. Every now and then I'm lucky enough to play with James Montgomery, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. Christine, the Mohegan Sun All-Stars. As I said, Cocker rocks. I've got another band called the Silverbacks, kind of an English rock, Americana type band. There's all kinds of things.
I just can't thank you enough for being on Design U, because, you know, whether it's music or anything that a person has a passion for, I think you are an amazing role model for people being successful on their own terms and going after what they love.
Well, thank you. And I mean, your words are very kind. I guess I'm just still following my passion, and it's a blessing. And I'm very grateful for it.